Hi, this is Luke Phillips, recording the Glimpse from the Globe podcast here from the Caruso Catholic Center, and I am joined today by Glimpse senior correspondent straight out of D.C., Jack Crash Anderson. Jack, welcome.
Thank you, Luke. It's always a pleasure.
It's always good to have you here. So Jack is our resident Eurasia specialist, and today we're going to talk about the geopolitical challenges facing various parts of the Eurasian supercontinent. So, Jack, if you can give us a quick overview of Eurasian geopolitics, talk about the Hardland-Rimland theory, and just talk about the different regions real quick, and then we'll get into the nitty-gritty details.
Sure. So I'm sure most of Glimpse's readership and listeners here today are avid followers of international affairs. That tends to be our audience. So I'm sure many of them are familiar with Eurasian geography and are probably familiar with the fact that throughout history, it's always been a volatile continent. And the reason for that, ultimately, according to many who have studied the region's history, comes back to its geography, which has many advantages and disadvantages for the construction of civil societies. And the thing is, the northern part of Eurasia, the temperate zone where you experience the four seasons, is essentially one big, vast plain from east to west, all the way from France across into Mongolia and Siberia. And if you go back throughout history, hordes of conquering armies and diseases and trade routes have traversed this terrain. And it is the cornerstone of how peoples and nations on the Eurasian continent interact. And we're continuing to see in our lives today that this corridor of activity spanning from China through Europe is busier and busier every single day. And the impact has been economic growth in some places and wars in others.
So that's the northern temperate zone of Eurasia. Can you talk a little bit about the Rimland regions and how they're separated by various oceans, mountains, and deserts, and all those areas?
So, of course. So to differentiate, the central mass of the great Eurasian plain, so to speak, is generally called the Heartland, and this originated with a fantastic work by Sir Halford Mackinder, who is a British geographer. And this is the zone that doesn't really drain to any of the oceans surrounding the Eurasian continent. It doesn't go to the Atlantic, it doesn't go to the Indian, it doesn't go to the Pacific. It either ends up in the frozen wastelands of the Arctic Circle or water drains inwards to the Caspian and what used to be the Aral Sea. But around the fringes, as you move in a circular pattern to the south, you end up in Anatolia and the Balkans and the Middle East, which is a very different type of geography and not conducive to nation building, to the development of civilizations. The Balkans are mountainous, rugged, and it's hard to unite people across terrain that is generally impassable, except for in small pockets. In the Middle East, you have essentially a perpetual food and water shortage that has existed there for millennia. It's a desert region, and it has a population that exceeds its available resources in terms of the demands of the populations for things like water. And that basic lack of food and water turns into a basic lack of pretty much all necessities that we take for granted for our lives here in North America. And that generates economic and development, and that spawns political challenges, which are playing out now in the worst way possible. And they're only fragmented even further by ethnic or interreligious conflicts in the region.
Now, it's interesting you bring that up about the unique challenges of the Middle East and Anatolia being hard for civilizations to develop there, because as you know as well as I do, that's the very cradle of civilization. I mean, from the Sumerians.
That's the ironic point. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
But you know, I have a thought on that though. The acclaimed biogeographer Jared Diamond argued that one of the reasons why Europe became as powerful as it became was because they had a relatively harsh climate, and more importantly, they had many like mountain valleys that could incubate states that then competed with each other. And as they competed, they had to develop more efficient institutions and more effective technology. Perhaps something similar happened in the greater Middle East with the sheer number of river valleys, the Tigris and Euphrates, the Nile, the uplands of Persia, developing multiple civilizations that then competed with each other and maybe got inefficient over time, but in the earlier stages certainly were able to advance because of that kind of competition.
That's absolutely correct. And Jared Diamond, his book on that, I believe, is called Guns, Germs, and Steel. For any of our listeners who would be interested in reading it, it's a tremendous volume. Yeah, that's definitely true. In the so-called biblical times, you know, before Christ, Old Testament era of humanity, about which we have very little written history outside of religious texts, climatologists believe that in this period of time, the Middle East was, in fact, called the Fertile Crescent, is how we've given a moniker to it, because those were valleys such as the Tigris, Euphrates, that run through Iraq, and the Nile in Egypt. Those were much more lush, and the Jordan River Valley, for example, dividing Palestine, Israel, and Jordan, also very, that was considered the promised land in Judaic history. Because it was sweet and lush and an easy place to raise a people. Obviously, throughout time, this has changed, and it has changed drastically. And that has had to do with a number of factors influencing it over history. Climate change now is considered to be anthropogenic or human-induced, but back in those times, it most definitely was not. And we're actually, it's believed to be, we were at the height of a cycle in between ice ages in which we essentially had reached peak heat, and there was a lot of moisture and humidity helping to keep that area fertile and lush, and it was experiencing consistent rainfall. Now our climate patterns are completely different. But at the end of the day, what's really important is that humanity revolves around several natural resources that we always need. Those are oxygen to breathe, and water to drink. And when you put those things together, along with sunlight, you can grow food. And agricultural development is the basis for any functioning society that makes time for other pursuits, such as mining or leisurely activities. And I think it's really interesting to see that as humans migrate, we've always centered ourselves around river valleys because you have access to fresh water, you have access to generally fertile land, which is saturated by rainwater that then later flows into the river. And that land becomes agriculturally prosperous, especially if you're in a flood valley where you can have cyclical rainy seasons, for example. Same thing holds true in India and Bangladesh and the Indian subcontinent in general, where you have a rainy season every year, the monsoons. And that spurs economic and agricultural and civil development in the nations of the Indian subcontinent. And the same thing plays out in East Asia, from Indonesia all the way up to the Koreas. There are astonishing similarities across all those societies in the ring, from Europe, and it used to exist more in the Middle East than it does now, that desertification has taken hold, but from Europe to the Indian subcontinent to East Asia, those regions in modern history, with the exception perhaps of World Wars I and II, have been generally very stable and have seen a lot of economic and developments that have never occurred at such a breakneck pace in history. Meanwhile, the other two regions of Eurasia, being the Middle East and Russia and Central Asia, the former Soviet Union, have generally unfavorable climates for agricultural and civil society development, and have floundered in various states of conflict. Obviously, there are exceptions. For example, you know, Spain, despite being a perfectly habitable country, had a bloody civil war. Same for China in between and after the Great World Wars. But at the end of the day, it really tells you a lot about the trajectory of a nation if you can understand its basic environment. And therefore, by understanding the environment, you can make some informed guesswork about how a nation's people will develop themselves, how their society will shift with time. And that's kind of the one constant, without venturing into geographical determinism, it's kind of the constant basis for human history. The environment that we live in.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the different, you mentioned the Spanish Civil War. It's interesting you bring that up. I think Robert D. Kaplan, who I did an interview with about a week ago, and who you should definitely do an interview with sometime too, Jack, he would probably talk about the intersection between fate and agency and the notion that there are these big macro historical forces, of which geography and climate are two of them. But at the same time, the human will and human institutions and human society nonetheless have an effect on what happens too. And sometimes in extreme cases, there are great individuals. Sometimes it's more collective cultural decisions. And sometimes it's even just there's theories about civilizational decay and state decay that are fascinating. But these all take place on the terrain, literally the terrain of geopolitics. And as you state, that is something that really needs to be understood if you're going to understand the decisions nations' leaders will make and the situation a nation's culture finds itself in.
Absolutely. And human ambition is something that can never really be attached to a geography or categorized by a geography. For example, the Spanish Civil War is a great example because a country tore itself apart simply because of political arguments and the implications of those contests. My way of thinking about it is that Marx could have been anybody from anywhere, right? I mean, if Karl Marx had been a citizen of an African nation or a South American nation, his ideas still probably would have spread like wildfire. And the communist revolutions that the world experienced simply would have happened in different places and perhaps with different repercussions. But he didn't have to be from a European country necessarily to have those ideas. It did help that European society had a very literate society and that his ideas could flow perhaps more freely there than they did in other places. But at the end of the day, who you are and what you elect to do with your life, it is more up to you than it is to your environment. It's how you react to your environment that's really nobody can predict that. But human beings tend to have a pattern for their behavior. So when a group of people are faced with a region that is full of mountains, they're more likely to live in the valleys between them because that's where water accumulates than they are to live at the tops, where they might perhaps have to melt snow by building fire. That means cutting down a tree and dragging it uphill to build a fire and melt your snow to get your water. It's easier just to be at the bottom of the mountain. So you can make some inferences about human behavior based on geography, but you cannot make educated guesses about everything.
Right.
It's possible for conflict to arise anywhere. And I think you have done some really brilliant research on, for example, the geopolitics of California, which has a really amusing geography, to be perfectly honest. It's got a little bit of everything all packed into one state.
You would never know
based on its geography that this is where Hollywood would be built.
Right.
Right.
Well, some people would disagree because it's really sunny down there and it's also pretty dry. So, which is apparently is good film conditions for the technology of the early 20th century when Hollywood was growing up. But it's there. Climate is there, and culture is there, and technology is there too. Now, back to your geopolitics of California thing. I assume you read my blog post on that a while back. If the union ever does dissolve and we have a Governor Pinto and a President Haas and all these, and California has to figure out how to geopolitically maintain itself, then I will pay to bring you out here to bring your geopolitical analysis to the governor of California so that we can maintain our independence and keep our water and food resources secure from the marauders from the east. So we will keep that in mind. We will keep that in mind.
Yes, you will have a hard time securing those groundwater resources. Just even amongst yourselves is hard enough.
It's true. It's true.
Bother throwing in Arizona.
Well, we're digressing a little bit now into the realm of fantasy. So I want to take the conversation a little bit back into the serious realm. We're about at the halfway point right now. So one of the concepts we brought up earlier that I think is really important for the understanding of geopolitics is the notion that it happens across both time and space. Space, in the sense of just geography that's there and whatever the climate is at any given point. But bear in mind, there's also a quote-unquote vertical aspect of it in the sense that climate changes. And, I mean, if you want to go into the millions of years, then geography changes and tectonic plates shift. Perhaps at a faster rate in terms of sea levels nowadays, and at certain times in history with the ice ages and such. Jack is exactly right that there are certain times in geologic time where societies are more capable of being set up. I think one of the really interesting things about geopolitics moving forward is how the rapid warming of the climate is going to influence the influence geopolitics moving forward. Now, I mean, I'm not one of these green types who goes and says, "Oh, well, all the cities are going to go underwater and that's going to change everything," because I just don't see it happening. But that said, there's been a lot of work done on the new creation of the Northwest Passage, which we looked for hundreds of years, and now it's there. The notion that agricultural changes might bring oranges back to China, like Marco Polo found apparently, or even more, what does that do to global migration flows and population flows? I mean, we're in the greatest refugee crisis since the Second World War nowadays, yes. So there's no telling what kind of stuff can happen. So it's when understanding geopolitics, it's literally not just about the geography. It's also about the demographics. It's also about the economic development. It's also about the climate. It's also about the political institutions. And it's about all this kind of stuff. You really do need to have a multifaceted understanding to have this understanding of how it works. And I would say geopolitics is not something that happens in history. Geopolitics is history as it happens. And it's important to understand how that works if you're going to do anything about it. You know, Jack, I'll let you talk in a minute, but one of my long lifetime goals, I think, so an early goal, I think, is going to be to write a geopolitical history of the United States. But long term, I want to write a geopolitical history of civilizations and see how that goes. Maybe you can co-write it with me.
Maybe. I would be more than happy to contribute some research there. I think you're absolutely right, and it's kind of tough to acknowledge sometimes that geopolitics encompasses so many other fields, and I think that's why sometimes that broad definition of this academic study, it's tough to pin down exactly what it is and what its implications are. People say, why not just be a demographer? Why not just be an economist? Why not just be a historian or a psychologist or a climate scientist? And at the end of the day, for better or for worse, all of these things interact. And sometimes they interact in ways that we've never seen before. And I think some of the base assumptions that geopolitical students have normally worked with are now eroding. And it's really going to take scholars of international affairs and policymakers and even journalists like us, it's going to take everybody for a ride. One of the core assumptions of geopolitics is that the lay of the land on planet Earth here is generally stable. As long as the field has really been around, the nature of the surface of the Earth has never changed so fast as to affect people within a single individual lifetime. In this century, I think that might change. And while I do agree that most metropolitan areas are not going to be underwater, some might. Miami, for example, or New Orleans that lay at or below sea level, especially on the west side of an ocean basin where, due to the rotation of the Earth, water has a tendency to slide towards the west a little bit. you know, those are places that will definitely be affected by this climate change. More importantly, the desertification that we're witnessing, especially in Africa and in the Middle East and Central Asia, that's going to drive people into competition over water even more than they have before. There already is a great amount of competition for freshwater resources on our planet. And it is possible in some cases that this could result in nation states coming into direct military conflict with one another. Do I think it's likely? No. I think there are cooperative ways to work out most trans-border, transnational water disagreements. You know, smart management is really the biggest challenge that we face. It's having effective political institutions that can handle the problems of the 21st century. Unfortunately, there's a good number of nations right now that are ill-equipped for a variety of reasons, as far as their political institutions go, to handle the challenges that they're likely to face. A few that come to mind right now are always at the top of the headlines. Ukraine and Syria, or the broader Middle East. The environmental situation in the Middle East is not getting better anytime soon. And war-torn countries are essentially failed states. Syria right now, you can consider a failed state. And it has no capability to provide things for its people, much less even keep them under control. And that, you know, the causes of the Syrian civil war are myriad. But at the end of the day, the Assad regime was not favorably viewed by a large contingency of its population. And that has exploded into a conflict which is now essentially a proxy between a resurgent Russia and the West, while East Asia looks on curiously saying, what are these people doing? You know, Ukraine, another country that has seen a lot of political instability recently, something of a civil war that is now quieted down but may reignite at any particular moment. And this is a country that, as resources become scarce, it will become more valuable. And that poses a different set of challenges than those facing areas faced with desertification. Ukraine is a very fertile country. It has great agricultural land, and it's also a major trade route for natural resources, not just food, but also oil and natural gas coming out of Central Asia and Russia to European markets. The European economy, as much as it is stagnant, will always depend on some massive amount of energy and food supplies coming out of Eastern Europe and broader Eurasia via Ukraine. And as those commodities become eventually harder to get at, the prices will go up and the value of Ukrainian territory will, in the global real estate market, essentially increase and appreciate very rapidly. And that will make any conflicts over Ukrainian territory or involving the nation of Ukraine that much more fragile. So that's something to look forward to in, say, a decade or so, after energy prices will rebound. I can't say if it'll be tomorrow or 10 years from now, but energy markets are generally almost random, to be perfectly honest, statistically random as to what the price of oil or natural gas futures might be on a particular day. But so those are the challenges that geopolitical analysts are going to face. The world that we've always worked with doesn't work the same. The rules and the base assumptions that we've always had are changing, and that's going to affect the field in ways that we're not entirely sure. We could see climate studies become more of a distinct field. For example, climate sociology might be something that rises to prominence. I've just kind of made that up off the top of my head. But it's
sounds like you have your own PhD set up.
What's that?
Sounds like you have your own PhD program set up now.
I'm not ready to do a PhD yet, but maybe someday. So what are your thoughts on this matter?
So it's interesting that you bring up the nature of change in geopolitics. There was a really obscure book by a scholar in India called Geopolitics and History. And one of the basic foundational principles that he brought about that I think is attested to by historians from William H. McNeill to Walter Russell Mead to all the whole shebang, Michael Lind, all of them, is that technology is one of the few things that progressively advances, if not the only thing that will always progressively advance. And that changes the nature of the game. It changes the meaning of geography for human civilization. I mean, when you look at agriculture, we used to live in the hills, you know, because that was where resources were better distributed and that was where we were safer. Once agricultural technology was set up, that changed the importance of geography to us, and we started building cities in the plains, and we started developing political institutions that were more centralized so that it could take advantage of larger amounts of labor and stuff like that. So that's just Neolithic technological change. Fast forward, 8,000 years, 6,000 years? Look at how air power changed geopolitics. Now, I mean, granted, land power and sea power advocates will always say, not that much. But, you know, I mean, the ability to lift things around the world and lift people around the world in a couple hours really does change the nature of the game. So I would say that we mentioned geopolitics is horizontal and vertical in different ways. One of the ways it's vertical, I think, is the fact that human society evolves and human technology progresses in ways that cannot necessarily be predicted earlier on. Okay, so we are getting about almost time here. We have about 3 minutes left. But you know, Jack, I want to propose to you something. I think it would be really, really interesting if me and you did a whole series of podcasts on the geopolitical conditions either of the various regions of the world, or perhaps we could get even more nitty-gritty, do a little bit more research, and do geopolitical analyses of particular countries, Russia, China, India, the United States, the whole shebang.
Yeah, that could go really well. And I think it would be good to take it a region at a time, because you know, different parts of the world are experiencing the phenomena that we have today in very different ways.
Right.
One thing I was going to touch on when you mentioned technology is the place you've seen the biggest impact of modern technology on political society is in East Asia, which the region was absolutely shredded as far as its institutions and its infrastructure in World War II and the Chinese Civil War. And with the thermonuclear weapons being deployed in Japan and Korea being torn apart by its civil war, those are three societies that have essentially completely been reborn like a phoenix out of the ashes since the late 1950s. And because of that unfortunate and tragic level of destruction that they experienced, they had to start from the ground up. But in doing so, they seized upon an opportunity to deploy viable technology, which when European and American cities were being built didn't exist. So you see transportation and utility infrastructure in those countries that is mind-blowingly efficient. And that's really, especially in metropolitan areas, been powering the economic development that has been behind the Asian tiger economies, so to speak. So I think that's a really fascinating example of the way technology interacts with how our world works. And it'll be really amazing to see in the future what kinds of technologies are developed and how they get deployed in different places and how they interact with cultures and geographies. It's going to be a fascinating number of years we're looking forward to here, despite the negativity we often see in the news, whether it's wars or bombings or shootings, or you know, these things tend to grab headlines. But at the same time, there's a lot of good news out there, and sometimes it's hard to find. But
how old are you? 23, 22?
Yeah, yep, you are too. Right?
Yeah, I'm 23 now. Yeah, so we both got at least 8 decades left or so, given current medical trends. So we will see where the world is in about 2096.
over the course of the century.
Well, you know, I keep hoping one of my goals is like to be important enough in 2076 that I can give a talk for the tricentennial of the United States. So we will see what the world has turned into by then. So anyways, we are out of time right now. Everybody, thank you for joining us. Jack, thank you very much for the fascinating conversation. This was
It's always a pleasure to have another great conversation at Glimpse from the Globe.
It's a really great pleasure to be with you here. And, you know, we should do this more often. So we'll get the whole series planned out. We'll start doing region by region and perhaps country by country, maybe even historical situation by historical situation, geopolitical analyses headed up. That is in the future, though, in the farther future, in the near future. Listeners, join us again next week when I sit down with Lena Bisokomian over at Policy Pair for the Globe and Pair podcast, and that is a biweekly affair. The rest of the Glimpse series will be a weekly affair. In the meantime, have an excellent evening, read up on geopolitics, and we will see you next time. Have a good one.